Today at Reader's Corner, Craig Foster, author of Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. How can we live in harmony with the wild, which is humanity's natural state? How can we have an intimate connection with wildness when so much of the modern world seems destined to tame us? These were the questions our guest today, Craig Foster, asked as he wrote his book, Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World. Part memoir, part love letter to nature, it covers a life spent exploring the most incredible places on Earth. From the great African sea forest to the crocodile lairs of the Okavango Delta in northern Botswana, author Craig Foster reveals how we can attend to the earthly beauty around us and deepen our love for all living things, whether we make our homes in the country, the city, or anywhere in between. Craig Foster is a filmmaker, naturalist, author, and ocean explorer. You certainly know him if you know that he won an Oscar at the 2021 Academy Awards for his documentary film, My Octopus Teacher. And he is the co-founder of Sea Change, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the long-term conservation and regeneration of the great African sea forest. Craig Foster, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much, Bob. Great being with you.
Well, as I was telling you before we went on the air, Craig, we're hitting a milestone here. We always thought that Shanghai, China was the farthest we've ever gone for an interview. That was over 4,000 miles. But we did some better today by interviewing you. We're going over 6,000 miles south of Cape Town, actually, Cape Town, South Africa. So this is a great achievement for our station and our program here. And it's especially delightful to have you here based on your book. But first, before we get to the book, I just want to say again, congratulations on The Octopus Teacher. It's a global phenomenon. As I said again before we went on the air, I still have people asking me about it. Have I seen it? And winning the Academy Award for Best Documentary, you can't say anything better than that. You say in your acknowledgments that without the presence of The Octopus Teacher in your life, this book would never have been written. Why is that?
Thanks for that, Bob. Appreciate it. I think who's going to sign some unknown person up from the end of Africa to write a book unless they have got something to show? So, you know, the Octopus Teacher's opened up so many doors for not only the book, but meeting, you know, incredible people, the United Nations, having a say in the conservation side of things as well. So it's a huge door opener for many things.
Well, your book, Amphibious Soul, ranges way beyond the octopus with its wide-angle lens, introducing the reader to all kinds of diversity in and out of water. And I'll go there in a minute. But before I leave the octopus, I want you to share with our listeners a couple of experiences that you had with the octopus. One, when you were young and you were with a friend and his father. And his father had a VHS along with him. I guess you could say it inspired you. Also, at the same time, it was rather scary given how much this octopus seemed to like you. Why don't you tell that story?
Thanks, Bob. You've clearly read the book very in great detail. We were up the coast as, you know, teenagers, and we were diving in a river mouth, quite a dangerous place, but it was calm that day. And I went down, wasn't overly deep, and there was this enormous octopus. I'd never seen an octopus this size. And I was kind of mesmerized by this animal. And in retrospect, I think it was what's called a giant southern octopus, which is quite rare to see here. And I was just mesmerized by it, but got too close to it. And I think the animal got a little bit of a fright and grabbed me and actually pulled me into its den. And it was so big and so strong that I realized that it was three or four times my strength. So I realized to survive, I just have to keep dead still. And it was really the only thing to do. And the animal, you know, soon realized I was no threat, and probably, I don't know, it wasn't very long, but it let me go. but all the skin was scraped off my arms from being dragged into the den with such force. And it was somehow not traumatic in any way. It was just a strange and powerful experience.
Well, the other experience I can think of, again, from reading your book, is I would call it more hilarious than anything else. I've heard octopuses are smart, but I didn't know they could do this. And this is the time that you and your wife, Swati, were swimming, and you came across an octopus that decided to really take a liking to Swati. And then you can explain what happens after the octopus departs, or what you learn after the octopus departs.
Yeah. So this was in quite a long time ago, in the early days. And we hadn't been married long. And I'd made Swati this beautiful wedding ring from a horn of a springbok that I'd found. Sometimes the horns break off when they're sparring. And it was actually in the intertidal, in the shallows. And this octopus came out and grabbed Swati's hand, and she was mesmerized by it. And then it sort of moved away. And too late, we realized it actually had stolen the wedding ring off her finger. And we never got that wedding ring back. But it was kind of, we were okay with it. It was a good place for it to go.
Exactly, exactly. Well, let's talk about the way you open up your book. You had this, what I could only describe as a harrowing experience, tracking a Nile crocodile in northern Botswana. Tell us a little bit about that. I think it was a kelp forest you were in. That was a scary moment.
Yeah, so this was quite a while ago. And this was actually in the Okavango Delta. So it wasn't a kelp forest. It was, it's an environment that's, it's like papyrus, basically. So you get these massive papyrus beds, which are full of thick, tangled roots, and then the river running through that. And the crocodiles live in lairs in that thick, tangled environment, and they've got like long tunnels. Kind of the early days when I was still looking for wildness and trying to go to the wildest places to find it. And we had this idea, which we thought was a good idea at the time, to try to get into the lairs of these crocodiles where they drag their prey and film this. And it was a quite a terrifying experience, but somehow we managed to actually eventually find an animal that was quite relaxed, and we followed it along this tunnel into this lair where it drags its prey, and it allowed us to film us in there and then get out safely. But it's kind of not the sort of thing I would ever do now. What I ironically found was that true wildness was to be found actually in the Great African Sea Forest here, with animals that weren't dangerous at all that I could visit every day, these small mollusks, we call them limpets. And just watching them every day and understanding their deep behavior was actually a much more powerful way of getting into understanding wildness than going into a crocodile's lair. But I had to go through these, you know, sometimes very terrifying experiences to find the path to that place of understanding what wildness is really about.
So help us visualize what a kelp forest is, the Great African Sea Forest, for example.
Yeah, it's a really unusual environment. So we have a kelp forest here that surrounds the tip of Africa, and especially up the west coast of South Africa. And it's a giant underwater forest. It's attached by holdfast or roots to rocks, and it grows as much as 15 meters or 45 feet in height. And at the top, basically the tube is filled with gas, so it floats, and on the top are these big leaves. So when you're in this forest underwater, the sunlight comes through like in beams because the leaves are so thick on the top. So it's a very magical underwater environment. Feels like you are in a very misty forest on land. And these big beams of light are coming through from the top, but it's, of course, reverse gravity. So you can fly through the forest. It's a very magical, powerful experience, especially if the water is clear. And these forests actually occur on 30% of the coastlines all around the world, but they are different species. So the forests look, in California, they look different to the ones here in South Africa and in Chile or in Australia, they look different again.
Are they under threat?
Yes. So kelp forests are the second most threatened ecosystem only to coral reefs in the world. So they're quite susceptible to climate change, to all sorts of other things. So we've had, in California, I think it's Southern California, 90% plus of the kelp forest has been lost. On your East Coast, I think 100%. Australia's lost a lot of their forests. So they are under threat. Luckily, here in Africa, we still have a very viable forest. And other parts of the world, they're more stable.
Today at Reader's Corner, Craig Foster, author of Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World. You've spent much of your life underwater, observing and filming wildness, and you did that most of the time without a wetsuit. And I don't like the cold to begin with, but reading your book, I really got cold, thinking of you in that water without a wetsuit. Can you explain the physiology of that? I would think hypothermia would set in.
I was in today, and sometimes it is difficult. It's the middle of winter here. The air temperature is quite cold. The water's quite cold, and you always have. Well, sometimes one has a bit of hesitance, but when one's in the water, suddenly it just feels so amazing because the cold changes your brain chemistry very radically. Enormous increase in dopamine and adrenaline and so on. And if you keep calm, the cortisol, you can keep that right down. So you feel absolutely fantastic with the cold once you've got used to it. You've got to build that resilience slowly, and we build these brown fat heaters in the body build up, and then the natural heaters. But it's not every day is easy. If you're feeling like you haven't slept much or you've got much a lot of stress, then one's cold resilience drops. So that's almost a mirror to how you're feeling and how your health is. But there's something very special about having no wetsuit and just being very close to that environment. And when I was diving a lot, I could go for a long time without a wetsuit, and it felt fabulous. And it sharpens the mind. So the underwater tracking is improved. Your understanding of animals is improved, even though maybe your time is more limited.
But you did have to protect your ears, as I remember reading. Isn't that correct?
Good memory. My ears grew 90% closed from the cold. It's called like a surface ear or oral exostosis. So now I just have little earplugs and a little hoodie to try and stop that going 100%, because then you need to have an operation. You need to be out of the water, which I don't want to be. So that's stopped it now. So I just have that little bit of protection.
Well, after you tracked the Nile crocodile in northern Botswana, you decided to return home. As you said earlier, the great African sea forest was right there at your feet where you grew up. But also, you visited the people of the San. Who are they, and what does that teach you that really changes your way of looking at the natural world? Or maybe I should say hearing, because there's something in this lesson called seeing with sound.
Yeah, great question. Thanks, Bob. The San are many different language groups who live in southern Africa, and they have a genetic heritage going back 120,000 years. So they're the oldest group of people that we know of on this planet, and they have an extraordinary hunting and gathering tradition and an incredible culture. The Kalahari is kind of the most famous place where some of the groups live. And I was very lucky in the late 90s to spend some time with three master trackers. And after that, that was in the central Kalahari in Botswana. And then I got to spend time in northeastern Namibia with another group of incredible trackers. And to be able to, for a short period of time to just be completely in the wild with people who spent a large lot of a part of their time living totally connected to animals and are able to converse with nature at a very profound level through this tracking. And as you say, they understand what's called bird language very, very well. So they can see with sound, and the tiny birds are sending them messages, sometimes from kilometers away. So they can see in their minds through the sound a leopard moving 1.5 kilometers away, or a big raptor, an eagle. And it's almost magical at first when you see this unfolding, but then there's actually a clear mechanism behind it. And when I was first, introduced to them, and myself and my brother spent months living wild in the Kalahari with these extraordinary people, changed our whole sense of what it means to be human. And you felt this enormous heritage, this wild heritage, actually hundreds of thousands of years in terms of our Homo sapien heritage, and millions of years going back to our deeper ancestors. So you got a totally different sense of what it means to be human.
There seems to be another example elsewhere in your book about this concept of seeing with sound, and it takes the reader to India. Your wife Swati's research interest is the Bengal tiger, and in this province where she's studying them, there's like 80, I think, left. And one is the elusive queen mother of Bengal tigers that you are on with a group of people trying to see this animal. Tell us about the clues that help you discover she was near.
Thanks for that. So it was I was in the early days of meeting Swati, and it was quite an extraordinary experience being with somebody in a completely different country who was also using the bird language that I'd come across, and the animal language actually that I'd come across in the Kalahari. So she was first honing in on the calls of various primates, and they told her that it was either a tiger or a leopard or another big predator in the environment. And then when the big antelope made the call, then she absolutely knew 100% it was a tiger, and she could predict where that tiger was going to appear. And at first I was pretty skeptical, and then this enormous animal just stepped out exactly where she predicted. And it was just this shockwave went through my body. And I knew I was, I'd met my soulmate. It was quite an extraordinary experience.
While we're on the subject of Swati, you also had a most unusual proposal, as I remember
We were in the Andaman Islands, where these tropical islands off the south of India, and Swati was still learning to swim and dive. She'd had a bad experience as a child, almost drowning, so it took a long time for me to get her comfortable in the water. And I actually wrote in the sand, in pieces of coral, maybe 100 meters out in the ocean, "Will you marry me?" Now I had to try and get her out there with the mask for her to see it, and the fish kept pushing the pieces around. So eventually got it all in place, and I had to tell her there was some incredible animal that she had to see. And then I coaxed her out there. And then the funny part was she saw it, but she was still so afraid of the water, she couldn't take her snorkel out of her mouth to say yes or no, because that was the only thing sort of keeping her alive. So we had to wait to get back to the shore, and then luckily I got the yes.
That's a great, great tale. Well, speaking of incredible experiences with fish, let's talk about the cuttlefish. First of all, what is it, and what's its size, and then its most interesting capability in and out of water? I guess this is the title of your book. He's an amphibious soul.
Yes, so we have quite a few species of cuttlefish. They're the cousin of the octopus, so they're a cephalopod. They have 8 arms like the octopus, but they've got 2 tentacles. Octopus do not have any tentacles, and these 2 tentacles can shoot out much like you would see a chameleon shooting its tongue out, and then they have suckers on the end of these tentacles that can grab the prey and pull them in. And some of these cuttlefish are even better at camouflaging themselves than an octopus. And I found one particular species, the tuberculate cuttlefish, that I've studied for many years. And this animal is so clever that it mimics other animals. So if there's a predator there, it will pretend it's a whelk with a hard shell, and it's actually completely changed into that animal. And then the predator looks and sees, oh, there's a whelk, it's too hard, I'm not even going to bother to attack. And it will even pretend to move like a whelk. Then it will change into a fish. Then it will change into a hermit crab. It's the most extraordinary animal. Then it'll change into a spiky animal that looks all prickly. So these cuttlefish are absolutely extraordinary. I think what you might have been referring to when you say amphibious animal, you might have been referring to the giant clingfish, which is quite confusing,
That's
or
right.
rock
That's the one that
sucker.
can stay out of water.
So this is a fish that I've studied also for many years, extraordinary fish that can actually surf out the water to catch limpets, and it can breathe for many hours out the water as long as it stays damp. And I've seen them surfing, 2 meters up a rock, and they've got this suction pad underneath the body, and they can stick to the rock and eventually get to the limpet, grab it in its big teeth, twist, and then drop back into the water and swallow the limpet, shell and all. It's the most remarkable amphibious predator that I've ever come across.
Today, I'm speaking with Craig Foster, author of Amphibious Soul. The book is a lyrical memoir drawing from the author's decades of daily ocean dives, wisdom from indigenous teachers, and cutting-edge science. Tell us about the Sea Change Project. You have a number of projects underway, all of which I think are designed to guarantee the success of the sea forest and nature in general.
It's our NGO that we started 12 or more years ago, and it's a group of incredible scientists, storytellers, filmmakers, and our job is to protect the ocean, especially the kelp forests. And four of our team are now heading to the United Nations Ocean Conference to try and get kelp forests properly protected. And the whole team is behind them and creating media, creating stories to make that happen. So we lobby at the United Nations, at the G20 for protection, and we use storytelling and the power of storytelling to make that happen. So we also we're studying 1,001 animals in the kelp forest and creating this incredible database and this app so that we can access all this information we've collected in great detail over the years. And we can share that and also use that as a powerful tool to show the biodiversity that we have here and how critical that is for the survival of the planet and how critical it is to protect it.
And that app's up and running?
It's not quite, it's up and running that we can use it at the moment, but it's not released
I
yet. We
see.
still have to add some more detail to
Okay.
that.
And it'll be called 1001 Sea Forest Species.
Absolutely.
And then the project Mother Nature in the Boardroom. Tell us about that and how you managed to get Jane Goodall to add her voice as Mother Nature to the script. Wow.
Thanks for that great question. It was a very exciting project. Our chairperson kept speaking to me about, he's an expert, Chris, on boardrooms and on corporate companies and how critical it is for big business to get behind biodiversity conservation. And we had to present, I had to actually present at the G20 in Brazil to the preliminaries to try and get the kelp forest on the agenda, because they'd been, largely ignored. So I was trying to think of what to do. And then with our team, we came up with this idea of how could we do a short film to represent Mother Nature in the boardroom. So I started with the octopus to catch people's attention. And then we recreated this amazing image of this giant Mother Nature sitting in the world's boardroom. And then I thought, well, who could be? I initially tried to do the voice of Mother Nature, but that, of course, didn't work. And I thought, who would be the best person to represent that? And I thought, Jane Goodall, is hardly anyone that can come close to her in many ways. And luckily, and this is another amazing thing with the octopus teacher, I had come to know Jane very well through my octopus teacher and had some incredible conversations. And she actually helped me write Amphibious Soul book in many ways. And I used to send her some of the stories, and she just inspired me so deeply. So I got hold of Jane and I said, is there any way we're going to the G20, we're going to actually, and we're going to go to the United Nations as well. Is there any way we could record your voice as Mother Nature? And she, her schedule is just insane. She hardly sleeps. And she was able to somehow, by herself, with her own computer, late one night, record the voice of Mother Nature and then send it to me. And it was just absolutely perfectly done.
Ah,
And
that's
that
great.
added the power to this piece, which is about 3, 4 minutes long.
Yeah.
We got to show it at the United Nations at Climate Week in New York, and it made a big impact. And now this piece has gone around the world. And I just heard actually this week it's been used by a Scandinavian group, and it's gone out to, I think, 5 or 10 million people just within that group. So this idea that Mother Nature and biodiversity is really the shareholder of every single one of our businesses. She's the shareholder of all our endeavors, everything we do. And we've kind of forgotten that. She's the base of everything. If you take away biodiversity, we don't breathe, we don't eat, everything we have, every government, every business, every household will collapse. So this is something that we desperately need to get into the psyche, into the story of our lives, because we take her for granted, and yet she keeps us living from minute to minute. So this is what this is about. And Jane was a wonderful person to help us get this message out.
I must thank you for the way you managed to introduce the reader to music that helps connect us to the nature world. Yo-Yo Ma and Zolani Mohola came out to join you. I believe it was to catch the sound of the sea forest. I've already downloaded some of Johnny Clegg and Savuka's music. I thought that was great. I liked your favorites that you identified in the book. So I think you've really done this just incredible job of spreading the good word across the planet as to just what we have to do if we intend for there to be a wild that we can reconnect with.
I think that if we do not have a wild to connect with, we won't have anything else to connect with. It's not like we can do without her. That's what we seem to have forgotten. But it does give me hope, Bob, that we have 3 million years of deep memory. We still have indigenous elders on this planet who understand this relationship very, very well. We know exactly what to do, and we desperately need to change the story from one of extraction to a story of reciprocity and working with Mother Nature and accepting her as the shareholder of all our endeavors.
That is a fitting conclusion to our conversation today with Craig Foster. He is, first of all, the creator of the Oscar-winning My Octopus Teacher, the documentary film, and he is also the author of Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World. Craig Foster, thanks so much for your work on the documentary, for your work on Amphibious Soul, which I strongly recommend our listeners buy and read very carefully. And thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
So wonderful talking to you, Bob. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The sound engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.